Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and my guest on the program today is Megan Husted. She's got a new book out. It's called More Than Conquerors, A Memoir of Lost Arguments. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Vic. It's good to be here.
I love your title.
Thank you. It took us a while to come up with that one. That was probably about the third title that we arrived at. It went through a few iterations before we settled on that. And, a lot of people who were raised Christian know that it's a reference to the book of Romans, Romans 8. And then for people who don't have that, you know, biblical literacy, it's totally mystifying. So, so it serves a purpose there as well, sort of piques people's curiosity.
Well, anyone that reads this book is going to realize that you have probably more biblical literacy than most.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. I'm a little rusty getting back into it now, but I was certainly seeped in it growing up.
I was absolutely thrilled just starting the book because you go back into your family history a little bit, and I am from Des Moines, and I was in Boy Scouts, and we used to go to our Boy Scout camp, Matigua, just outside of Boone, Iowa, every summer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I can picture.
Did you ever make it into Boone?
Oh, sure. Mamie Eisenhower's hometown, you bet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, so for people who haven't read the book, a little background. So Boone was a town, and it's northwestern Iowa, isn't it?
It's just a little bit outside of Des Moines.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't even looked at the map.
Central Iowa, yeah.
Where my grandfather and his brother grew up as little boys one of those strange places before Social Security and welfare programs, where people who were like their mother, who was a single mom with two boys, you know, who didn't want to go back and live with her family or in-laws, were kind of out of luck, and so they ended up at these institutions. They were like orphanages and sort of like homeless shelters and communes and all these things going on at once. And so that's where they grew up, in this sort of dorm rooming house for people who had nowhere else to go. It's oddly, you know what? It's still there, the building.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother and I stopped in Boone a few years ago, and on this road trip from Minneapolis to Tucson, which was quite a trek. And we stopped in Boone, and we're poking around there. And now it's a homeless shelter for men, but mostly empty. It was very odd. And it's such a small town that the fact that these two strange women were wandering around the premises, within 15 minutes, someone drove up and asked us what our deal was, why we were there, what we were doing. It was fascinating.
It is that kind of town. It's a sweet little town, though.
Yeah.
So this was, I'm guessing, maybe I'm reading too much into this. This is kind of where this part of your family really became involved in the Christian life.
That's probably true. Yeah, as the name Boone Biblical College and Associated Institutions suggest, it was an evangelical, probably born out of the Great Revival kind of place. And my grandfather from a very early age sort of knew that he wanted to become a pastor. And my mother's side of the family, her father was also a pastor, both Baptists, but Northern Baptists. I think there's a lot of people hear Baptist and they automatically assume Southern Baptist because they're certainly more present or have more of a platform in our culture. So the media pays more attention to them. But there is this contingent of Scandinavian bred Baptists. Mm-hmm. And that's what my family was like. And then my great uncle, Don Husted, went on to work with Billy Graham for a number of years. And then, well, that's six. It wasn't a huge part of his career, not even his most illustrious part of his career. He went on to work at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and write hymnals or edit hymnals. One doesn't write an entire hymnal unless you're very prolific. There's a real legacy there.
Megan Husted joins us. Her memoir is More Than Conquerors. You grew up in this family that had a life so much different than most Americans. You were on the road. You were living in these different places, and you break the book up into locations. And the first one is this island off the coast of Venezuela and this amazing radio station.
Yes, it was quite something. You know, it's still there. It's not used much, to the best of my knowledge, because most radio now is satellite. But they had this studio, and then down the road, in the southern part of the island, and it's a very scrubby, certainly at the time, it was not well-developed island. It was sort of a lot of wasteland. It was not the lush, tropical Bahamas, you know, kind of image that people have of the Caribbean. It was mostly, it was a desert island, really. Anyhow, the south side of the island, they had this transmitter site and these towers that were just the tallest structures by far on the island, and they were broadcasting shortwave, medium-wave radio at 500,000 kilowatts, which, to put in, I mean, you could probably tell your listeners, is about, or correct me if I'm wrong, it's about 10 times what's legally permissible in the United States.
Yeah, we call that a clear channel. I mean, you can hear a station like that all over the place.
Yeah, exactly. And if the atmospheric conditions were right, you could get that up in Canada, down in the Amazon Delta. They even had programs that were broadcast from the Caribbean that were in Hindi, because they knew that operators, the people with ham radios, they could pick it up in India. It's incredible.
And your dad worked for this organization, and you describe going down with your sister at night, and sometimes you're wearing your nightgowns and watching your dad trying to keep this thing going.
Right, yeah. He worked at the transmitter site for two-plus years, and then he was on the air. But, yeah, that was really magical because he had the graveyard shift, and there were these enormous Elco diesel engines, you know, several tons between the two of them to generate enough electricity to keep this station running. And there was so much ambient electricity in the air, and Lord knows how dangerous it was. Okay, there was always a stash of fluorescent light bulbs by the door, and you could grab one of these light bulbs and walk out towards the towers, and eventually the light bulb would illuminate.
Oh man!
In your hands.
Wow!
From all the ambient electricity, probably not the best gimmick health wise.
Yeah.
But we're all still standing, so it couldn't have been that bad for us.
So your family is there because he's working for this religious broadcaster, and part of the deal was you would take these furloughs and come back to the Midwest.
Yeah.
For what purpose?
To raise funds, to raise money. So as a missionary, you're sort of on a fixed income. You get paid by the missionary organization, but you also have to do your part in order to pay your way and make that possible for you to live overseas. And, of course, the Transworld Radio, which was the organization they worked for, got money from some of the programs, the people who produced the programs they distributed. They had some major donors, private donors, and then everyone, all missionary families, had to raise support. And that meant going back to your sponsoring church. We had one, I guess there were a couple others that were, you know, less formally sponsoring churches, and do like these slideshow presentations usually, you know, in the church basement, probably on a Sunday evening, or they'd have it on a Wednesday evening in lieu of a regular service, a worship service. They would have these missionary presentations. And, of course, you know, this was back when we were doing this. This was the late 70s, early 80s, and mid-80s even. And, you know, this was pre-Instagram, pre-Facebook, pre-Internet. Mm-hmm. So, of course, people could see pictures of these far-off places, but they were much rarer than they are now, and I think that's one of the interesting things about it. It was that it was exotic and exciting to people to see these images from all these different parts of the world. And then there would be some sort of meditation on the good work that we were doing, the people who were being touched by the gospel, and then it was you know, if not then and there, the hope was that people would pull out their checkbooks and support. And some people, did, you know, $25 a month. I think if we had one supporter that gave us like $100 or $150 a month, and that was considered like that was big money by our standards at the time. But it was a weird position to be in as a little kid because you were very aware that you were kind of a special class of people. You were missionaries, so when you came back to the States, you were kind of like a guest star. You know, people weren't used to seeing you around. But at the same time, you know, you were also very aware that you were basically a charity case.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, well, was awkward. You're wearing a lot of hand-me-down clothes and standing up there and smiling, making sure you don't do anything that's going to jeopardize the show. So that was, I have mixed feelings about that. Part of me looks back on that and think, oh, that's how wonderful and strange. And other part of me is like, wow, that was pretty awful at the same time.
You had to make a performance because your family's livelihood really depended on it. You had to...
Yeah.
Put on your best face.
And it was the whole family. You know, that's the part of the thing about missionary kids. It's like, it's a family business, although it's rarely talked about in those terms. But as children, you're part of the performance. You're part of the mission. And you're as affected by your parents' occupation. I guess not as affected. I said you are very much affected by your parents' occupation. Because you're with them, in these different cultures. And sometimes you're even more exposed to the foreign cultures that you're in because depending on where your parents send you to school, you know, they could send you to the little missionary or an expat school, or they could send you to the local schools. And that's what my parents did. So while they worked within the missionary organization, mostly dealing with people who were also American expats, working in the organization. My sister and I were at the local schools, which is great in terms of feeling part of those cultures and learning the language, but did certainly make us feel more exposed to some of the tougher stuff that happened.
And this island was a Dutch island, so they spoke Dutch, and you were kind of an outsider in that regard as well.
Outside in that regard, we're also very pale.
Right.
Very pale. I was the only white kid in my class in first and second grade. My sister was also the only white kid in her class. There were a couple other missionary kids who went to this school. Most of the other missionary kids went to the other school. There were only two elementary schools on the island. And the other elementary school had many more white faces, many more American missionary kids going there, but it wasn't a very good school. And the other one, the one that we went to, was a great school, but it was Catholic.
Mm.
And at the time, most of evangelical Americans, there was so much of that generation, there was so much distrust of Catholics. Mm. Now to us, I think to people now, it sounds kind of crazy. You know, this is a generation that came up, you know, when, like, came of age when, was it Kennedy? Didn't Kennedy have to go on? You know, make this speech about how he wasn't going to allow his Catholicism or his fealty to Rome and the Vatican get in the way of decisions that he made on behalf of the United States.
Yeah, I think they call that the Papist speech.
Yeah. Yeah, so right. There was such a distrust of Catholics. They didn't want their kids going to Catholic school for fear that somehow they would be indoctrinated in the wrong way.
The family then went to the Netherlands, and your dad had a job working for the radio network there, and things did not end well.
Yeah, no. It was pretty much a disaster. And I shouldn't laugh, but I'm laughing anyway. It was a disaster. It was sort of undone. It was a great idea. The idea was, we're going to start this school that will teach itinerant evangelists and pastors who are toiling in all parts of the developing world, in the Soviet bloc, et cetera, how to produce radio shows and how to communicate via this medium. And we're going to do that. We'll teach them how to do it and support them in their work rather than sending people like my father to, you know, Ghana, for example, to do it for them. You know, very much in the teach a man to fish line of thinking, and it was, and they had some really talented people there, but it was very, it was mismanaged, and it was really undone by all these office politics that were, they're ultimately petty, but yeah, and it was really disillusioning for all the people who were involved because they had put all the skin in the game, and they had prayed, and these people were really believed in prayer. And they were excited. My parents were excited. They really loved living in Europe, and it was just, it just did not work out, and it did not work out in a way that was so humiliating and disillusioning. And so then they ultimately quit, and then we moved back to the States about 4 years later.
Your father had conflicts with his boss, and mm-hmm. in the end, they tried to. They offered him a transfer to Sri Lanka, and he said, "I've had it. I'm done. I'm out of here." And you went back to the States, and your dad had a really tough time then, didn't he?
He had a really tough time. Yeah, it was. Well, one of the things that made it difficult was when we left, which was in 78, Carter was in the White House, and Carter had sort of run as an evangelical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he talked about teaching Sunday school. They asked him if he'd ever cheated on Roslyn. Is it Roslyn or Roslyn?
Roslyn. Uh-huh.
Roslyn. And he said, no, but I have lusted in my heart, which anyone who knows the New Testament knows what that he's referring to. But it wasn't as politicized. I mean, the moral majority started in 1977, but they weren't nearly as prominent. We came back to the United States in 1987, the tail end of the Reagan administration, and what it meant in the public eye, the public understanding, to be what it meant to be Christian was really different.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually thought, not unreasonably, that he had had all this experience. He had worked at transmitter sites. He had been on air. He had produced, he had worked, you know, writing stories about the invasion of Grenada, you know, based on UPI, you know, news feeds and AP stringers reports. And, you know, he knew how to put together a radio show. He knew how to, you know, write, what do you call it, copies, scripts.
Mm-hmm.
Could ad lib, he could do all that stuff. He had trained people in it, and then he came back and he thought, "Well, maybe I would love to work for, you know, Minnesota Public Radio."
Mm-hmm.
And they just sort of looked at him like he was insane,
a member of an alien race.
Yes,
right.
And so he ended up working, but you know, just back to the only institutions that had really ever supported him, even though they'd also really disappointed him, which was, which were, you know, churches. And, you know, he worked briefly as an adjunct at a Bible college, and those were really the only private sector place that would take him seriously. And that was really difficult and really disillusioning for him. And my mother just ended up, she's so pragmatic and this is roll up her sleeves kind of person, so she just, like, took one of the first jobs that was offered her because it paid really well, and at that point they just needed to make some money.
Mm-hmm. The book is More Than Conquerors, A Memoir of Lost Arguments. Megan Husted wrote it. She joins us on the program today. We see the divisions starting to occur in the family, divisions between you and your parents, between your sister and your parents. You sketch these out, but we have to sort of intuit what's going on.
Yeah, am I too coy in those descriptions, do you think?
I don't think so. I think that's some of the fun of reading it, is trying to figure out what's going on, particularly as far as the religion issues, as far as your dad saying, look, I voted for McGovern, but he became more conservative, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah.
He definitely did. And and it's hard to trace that arc. I think there's some real disappointment about aspects of his career that conservative political rhetoric just spoke to in a way that was more meaningful to him than liberal rhetoric was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, It's hard to explain why. I do think, though, like if you look at like Tom Frank's book, like What's the Matter with Kansas? He's like, why do all these people always vote against their economic interests? Doesn't make any sense. They must be laboring under some sort of false consciousness. And I think when I look at my father's experience, you know, that's not entirely fair. I look at my father's experience and his example. For him, economic interests are not paramount. They never have been. So why should that determine who he votes for? But yeah, when I was about 15 or 16, I was what I primarily remembered about when I looked back at my missionary experience was that that living overseas was had many, many gifts, but it was very difficult in other ways. And what I knew to be true of the church is that it had sort of overpromised and underdelivered as far as my family was concerned. And as a sort of a restless, angry, you know, snotty 16-year-old, I really wanted nothing to do with it. And so I started having arguments with my parents because I didn't want to go to church anymore. I mean, we were, of course, you know, every Sunday kind of family. And that was difficult for them because they did feel that they had failed as parents in some way. And I think also on some level, especially my mother, was worried about what other people would say. You know, what if, you know, what would she say to all those people who were like, oh, and where's Megan today, you know, after the service? That would be embarrassing for her. So it took many arguments that I won. And eventually they said, okay, that's fine. And to their credit, even though that was a real battle, that honestly, I remember the broad strokes of it, Vic, but I don't remember their particular discussions. That is all very fuzzy. Maybe my parents remember them better. But they said, okay, that's fine. And then when it was very clear that I was going to be living a quite a secular adulthood, they never once withheld love or support or affection from me, which I think hearing other stories from people who've written to me about the book, who sort of had a falling out with their parents about religion and then got so much guilt and so much shame from their parents, you know, literally their parent, their mother, like, crying, saying, this is the worst thing that could ever happen to me, you know, that kind of thing. And my parents never did that, and I think that's hugely to their credit. They were just consistently faithful, both to their religion, but consistently faithful to me, and honored their love and their commitment to be, you know, good, supportive parents, regardless of the choices that I was making. And I think that's pretty great, so... Cheers to them for that. But it was not an easy path.
I would call them true Christians.
Yeah, I think so.
They loved you regardless.
Yeah.
And they didn't withhold their love because of your choices.
Yeah, because my choices did not validate theirs. And I think that's a problem. Yeah, and not even Christian parents. I think a lot of parents look to their kids to validate themselves and the people that they are. And when their parent, when their kids deviate from that, they find it really threatening to their own identity. And I'm very lucky that my parents did not do that to me.
And you made the big move to New York, like a moth to the flame. And you're in New York now. Tell us about your life now. What do you do?
So I have a small company called Werethal Press, which despite the name Press, does not actually publish books yet. But I mostly help other writers and non-professional writers, but people who have book contracts or the desire to write a book, help them do that. I collaborate with them. I am their developmental editor. We can work from the book proposal on up to the finished book, line edits. And my clients are mostly working on nonfiction books. I work occasionally with novelists, but usually nonfiction writers who have an expertise in some field, be it nutrition or architecture or the history of science, you name it, current affairs, and or consulting. A lot of business writers too, but who need help getting their book project satisfactorily completed because they're so successful they don't have time to. to devote as much time to the book as the book needs. So that's my business. I used to work in book publishing, and I've been on my own for about 8 years now, 9 years. So it's been a tough ride, but I'm really lucky. I love it. It's great work.
You describe coming to the big city and getting that first job in publishing.
Oh, yeah.
And I was absolutely vicariously enjoying that.
It was so exciting. So thrilling. I remember, yeah, I was about 20. I was 24 when I got my first job as an editorial assistant. And that's sort of the entry level working as an editor. You really have to go up through the army. You're an editorial assistant. And then if you work really hard, then you're an assistant editor. Then you're an associate editor. Then you're an editor. Then a senior editor. And you just learn by osmosis. You learn by standing over the copy machine, making copies, by filling out mailing labels, by answering your boss's phone, and reading constantly. You know, we all had sore backs because every night we'd go home with like two or three full manuscripts in these tote bags, you know, sort of tottering under the weight. But it was thrilling. And then to, you know, the first time when you open up a box, like the guy from the mailroom delivers a big box of books that just came from the printers, and they're done, and you worked on it, and you know, even if it's something as simple as typing up the information that appears on the copyright page, you know, that was really exciting. And I still think it's exciting. And you know what? I think it's exciting even for my clients. Like, it's thrilling to see my book with my name on it. But it's no less thrilling to see my clients. Like, it's just sort of universally fun. It's an amazing feeling. And sometimes, you know, I've worked with writers who getting a break in publishing totally changed their life. I worked with one woman who worked on a proposal and everyone turned it down. It's one of these stories. Everyone turned it down. No one would publish it. And she says, you know what? Screw it. I really want you to tell this story. I'm going to write it anyway, and I'll eat crackers and, you know, tuna fish for the next year, but I just need to write this. And she did it, and then I picked it up when I was working at Counterpoint Press several years ago, and I had to publish it. Unfortunately, my boss and everyone else at the company agreed. We bought the rights, and, you know, before it even published, it had earned back in its advance because we had sold subsidiary rights, we had sold UK rights, and the woman went on to start reviewing books in the New York Times and get gigs here and there, and it just, you know, it made her career. And to be part of that and to be part of a group of people who are just putting the best of their ability into it, you know, from the jacket design to the interior design to the marketing people, you know, it's really thrilling. Because it takes so many people. I mean, I think it's one thing if you don't know how the book business works. You think, oh, there was a writer because you know, they wrote it. They might have had an editor and they might have had an agent, but that's kind of it, those three people. What it really takes for a book to work, it takes about 15 people and more to working in concert. And it's a beautiful thing.
I really agree. Is. Megan, yeah. We really appreciate your time today.
A pleasure talking to you.
Our guest has been Megan Husted. Her book is More Than Conquerors, a memoir of lost arguments. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.